The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Will Appleton with an episode of Chatter for December 4th, 2022. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Chatter, a podcast hosted by David Preece and Shane Harris that features in-depth discussions with fascinating people at the creative edges of national security. Today's episode of Chatter is entitled Pandemics and Political Violence with Brian Michael Jenkins. In the episode, Preece and Jenkins chat about the threat of biological terrorism, the links between social unrest and plagues, the history of public resistance to efforts to protect public health, and more. This is Chatter.
Welcome to Chatter. I'm David Preece, publisher of Lawfare. This week, terrorism expert Brian Michael Jenkins on pandemics and political violence.
We've seen in the United States a statistical increase of homicides by 38%. It's the largest gain that we've seen in many, many decades. People seem to be on edge, quick to violence. That was a feature that was noted in the Middle Ages following the Black Death, and we're seeing it again now. It's not necessarily that the pandemic causes these phenomena that we are seeing now, but pandemics exacerbate the existing inequalities and other fault lines of our society.
Brian, thank you for joining me on Chatter today.
Thank you for the opportunity. Looking forward to the conversation.
For those of our listeners who somehow aren't familiar with your decades of work, how do you summarize your life's research and the topics that you have focused on the most?
Well, I've spent the past five decades actually examining the field of political violence, terrorism specifically. We started RAND's research program on this in 1972, 50 years ago in the fall as well. I tell people, give me another 50 years, I'll have it all sorted out. But it has been a fascinating journey for me.
Well, in terms of that long sweep of looking at political violence, you've almost seen it all, right? You've seen, coming out of the 60s into the early 70s, the wave of political violence in the United States and in Europe that took one flavor, but then the Middle East terrorism that arose in that era, which was different in some ways from the more recent experience of 9/11 and its aftermath. But you've seen biological terrorism. You've seen attempts at, you know, chemical weapon terrorism. You've seen mass bombings. You've seen assassinations. And yet, when you look at the long sweep of political violence and terrorism, going back to the anarchist days 100 plus years ago, going back to experiences in Europe and around the world before that, what goes around comes around, doesn't it? I mean, aren't these simply reflections of previous waves of political violence?
That's true. Certainly, I mean, the words terror as a political instrument and terrorism did not really enter the political lexicon until the early 19th century, but certainly the phenomenon itself has far deeper roots. It goes back centuries when people have used violence, not simply on the battlefield to defeat enemy forces, but have used violence in ways to create fear and alarm. Indeed, I've described terrorism as a mode of theater, violence that is aimed at the people watching, where it is intended to produce, as I say, fear and alarm that will cause people to exaggerate the strength of the terrorists and the importance of their cause. That has been a recurring feature. In the more recent decades, really over the past half century, we've seen that particular form of violence become increasingly refined. It certainly has taken advantage of an arsenal that is available to almost everybody right now. Weapons have been democratized, so to speak. But perhaps most of all is the difference in communications that we've seen. You know, it was in 1968 that we saw the first deployment of communication satellites, which enabled us to watch the news, watch live feed from uplinks worldwide. And if you go back to my original concept of terrorism as theater, then the ability to reach an audience of global proportions has enhanced that particular type of violence at the same time that the possession of weapons of mass destruction by states has discouraged all-out warfare between states. So we've seen a substantial shift in the way wars are waged.
Absolutely. Well, I think some of the themes there actually will weave into the bulk of our conversation here, because I really want to talk to you about how pandemics affect armed conflict, terrorism, the use of biological weapons, picking up on themes in your recent work, including a book called Plagues and Their Aftermath, How Societies Recover from Pandemics. Tell us about the origins of this book. Back in the summer of 2020, how did you come to take your expertise on political violence and focus it in on the effects of pandemics as they relate to that and wider societal issues?
Well, to be honest with you, I hadn't set out to write a book about the topic. I was asked to write an essay, which was ultimately published in an academic volume in Europe, in Vienna, actually, on how the pandemic conceivably might affect the realm of political violence. That was clearly in my pasture. But since I was prevented by the pandemic from my usual travel schedule, I ended up using that time and reading more and more books about the great pandemics of history, and it became, in a sense, a journey for me to look back at these pandemics: the Great Plague of Athens, the Black Death, the pandemic of 1918, and to try to think about how that might really be replicated in the COVID-19 pandemic. Like any explorer, I kept notes and ultimately shared the notes with various other people. And one of them said, you know, you have a book in here. And so we basically took all of the notes and stapled them together and turned it over to a publisher. And it ended up with a book, Plagues and Their Aftermath. It's not really about pandemics themselves. It's not about epidemiology. It's not about the medical issues. That is far beyond my field. It's really about the consequences of pandemics, not merely in terms of lives lost, but in terms of the economic disruption and devastation, in terms of the way that they deepen divisions in society, in terms of their effects on individual and collective behavior, and the political consequences of this. So this is less about the dragon breathing fire and more about the thrashing dragon's tail.
And that's, it's amazing because you don't write a history of each pandemic. You're not retelling the story of the, as you said, the 1918 pandemic or the Justinian plague or the Black Death, but you have to know all of those. That is, you're bringing examples, you're bringing similarities and differences from across a dozen or more major pandemics and epidemics. So you had to research the heck out of it. And you came to one insight that I hadn't really thought about much, which is that here we are, what, 2.5 years, a little over 2.5 years into the COVID pandemic, and the societal fatigue wore in so much that even with successive waves in recent months, there's really been no move back towards shutting things down or even forcing masking in many public spaces because it's taken so long and it's been such a long trek. And that's not really the case. We tend to think of epidemics as finite events with a limited duration, but that's not true across history, is it?
Not at all. You know, you're absolutely right. People tend to think of pandemics as events with clear beginnings and clear endings, you know, from patient zero to, in a sense, an official announcement that it's over. That's not the historical pattern. Pandemics have very ragged endings and often are followed by, as in earthquakes, aftershocks. That is, not simply the new surges, but rather even years later, subsequent waves. I mean, you know, if we go back to the Black Death of the 14th century, the first wave was 1348 on through about 1351. But there were at roughly 10 to 20 year intervals, recurrences of the bubonic plague going on for over the next several hundred years. In the case of the cholera epidemics that swept across Europe in the 19th century, again, beginning in about 1830 and on up through the early 20th century, there were subsequent waves of cholera that affected vast areas of Europe. And of course, cholera remains a problem. We're seeing in places like Haiti and some other areas of the world where there are conflicts, the occurrence of new outbreaks of cholera. So cholera and armed conflict kind of circle each other like binary stars throughout history. So the endings are long and ragged, and one is never entirely certain that it's over.
I wonder how much of the popular conception of that, not necessarily the academic conception of it, which is obviously much more historically based, but the popular conception of that in the modern era probably has been influenced by movies and fictional representations. People can watch a movie about contagion or about an Ebola outbreak, and it fits nicely into a 90-minute or 2-hour frame where the scientists attack the problem and they figure out a way to contain it, or it becomes a zombie apocalypse. But either way, there is a quick resolution to it. And maybe it reduces the public's patience to understand that these do become endemic, right? So often many of these aren't finite events like an Ebola outbreak in one country in Africa, and it can be limited, but they end up becoming something that just becomes part of the human fabric.
That's true. And in many cases, we see these outbreaks of disease become, in a sense, endemic, something that we end up having to live with for a long period of time. I mean, even now, as you point out, people, certainly people in the United States, have declared their own end to the pandemic. They're done with it. That was something we came through. But, you know, you look at the statistics, and while the death rate has, you know, fortunately gone far down, we're still killing, on average, COVID-19 is killing at a run rate of about 120,000 dead a year in the United States alone.
Right.
Curiously, that has somehow become an acceptable figure now. When if I had said that, well, we're going to have a long-term run here of flus killing 120,000 people a year, that would have been completely unacceptable. The other thing that I think the COVID-19 pandemic underscores is that for a variety of reasons, relating to the close proximity of animals to a growing population, the rapidity, the velocity of modern travel, so that, you know, somebody sneezes in one part of the world and literally within a few days you have a pathogen that has crossed the planet, and possibly because of some changes we are seeing in terms of our climate, that we really do face a future in which outbreaks of disease, new diseases, are likely to occur. Not every one of them will become a dangerous worldwide pandemic, but certainly our ability to respond to new sudden outbreaks of diseases we're not familiar with, I suspect, is going to be tested again in the coming years.
You spend some time in researching and writing this, looking at the economic impacts of pandemics. And I don't want to gloss over those, but I'm going to, because I want to move to the stuff that's more interesting. But I do want to point out that the economic impacts do feed into the issues of public resistance and political dynamics, and ultimately to potential political violence. So the issues of unemployment and the widening of economic disparities, the suffering of some parts of the world more than others, the absolute poverty that can result from pandemics, all of those are real. And I don't want to minimize those, but I do want to feed that into the wider issue of public resistance to crackdowns. The COVID experience was the first experience that a lot of people had, especially a younger generation, to the idea of public safety measures at a grand scale, whether it's quarantining or shutdowns. And yet, crackdowns against pandemics aren't new. The Black Death, people, had the Red Crosses put on their doors and were isolated. But public resistance to crackdowns and popular uprisings, whether to vaccination efforts or whether to government efforts to protect public health, that goes back at least to smallpox in the 1770s, but certainly was widespread in the 19th and early 20th centuries, right? Give us some examples of that, how previous pandemics really should have given us some sense that there was eventually going to be some mass public, if not uprising, at least upset about the crackdowns that were put into effect.
Well, in fact, since the Middle Ages, it has been recognized that large-scale outbreaks of disease are dangerous, that they demand aggressive responses, that resulted in travel being restricted, that restricted trade. People, as you point out, people who were exposed or even possibly exposed were quarantined. That is kept apart until they presented no danger. And all of these had a devastating impact on the economies and the societies that they affected. And there was resistance, even in the Middle Ages, to these. Both there was resistance to the restrictions themselves. And of course, at that time, we did not have government-run programs to provide financial support to corporations and individuals facing economic stress. Survival was at stake, and public officials at that time who manned the gates at around the walls of cities were assaulted. Authorities that tried to enforce these rules were attacked. Doctors were attacked. People who came to take away those people who were infected with the disease, take them away to hospitals where they almost certainly were going to die and then be dumped into mass graves. There was, in many cases, armed resistance to that. So resistance to control measures is nothing new. Then in the aftermath of pandemics, governments often did things that resulted in further, provoked further resistance. For example, the Black Death, again, back to the 14th century, it killed off as much as half the population of Europe. This was really depopulation. We haven't seen anything like that with COVID-19. But that depopulation actually fundamentally changed the structure of society. Workers at that time were bound to the land. This was a feudal system, a manorial system. They weren't slaves, but they couldn't leave. They couldn't leave the property without permission of the lord of that property. They owed that lord so many days of labor. That was the lord's land. But with a sudden depopulation effect, there were far fewer workers, and that changed the balance. Really, workers were able to demand better deals because there was such a shortage, and they could take off from the manor and find work under better conditions elsewhere. The crown tried to correct this. It tried to reinforce these rules. Mm-hmm. It tried to make up for its own economic losses during the pandemic, and that in turn provoked greater resistance and even ultimately led years later to England's first social revolution in 1381. And so there's a direct sequence of events. We saw that again in the cholera epidemics in Europe in the 19th century, where the population resisted, and where that resistance reinforced the class divisions in society and probably had a significant impact in radicalizing European society.
That's fascinating that even in some historical cases where we don't have perfect information, we still can trace through some correlations at a minimum of these epidemics and some of the labor issues with supply and demand, the rights of workers, and social, if not social revolutions, at least social unrest. That is, they're all there. finding the causal relationships is a bit harder. That is, it's hard to say this pandemic caused this political revolution, but the elements are there. And it makes me wonder if, looking back at this with the experience you have of a similar issue, which is tracing political causes of terrorism, which is also not always a specific mathematical causal relationship, did you find that your changing views on this were in some ways expanded because of your ability to look backward and say, well, wait a minute, there are trends across these dozen or so pandemics that in each individual case, we may not be able to nail down that this pandemic in this country led to this political result years later. But if it happens enough times across enough countries, there is something to this effect.
Wow, that's a fascinating question. And you know, thinking about it for a moment, first of all, one ought not to overstate any notion that I could come up with these a tidy set of linkages, you know, from pandemic to social revolution. Indeed, the historians who have studied these events in far greater depth than I have are still debating the effects of the 14th century Black Death 700 years later. So it's not as if
that's a lot of dissertations and peer reviews and arguments right. At conferences.
But what was fascinating is how many times these same themes, these same lines of conflict emerged again and again, and therefore probably these historians of you know, plagues in the Middle Ages and pandemics in subsequent centuries would be, I think, very little surprised by what has occurred during COVID-19. That doesn't mean it occurred in the same way, but the same dynamics were there playing out. Now, how these will play out, here again, one wants to remain appropriately humble. We don't know. And indeed, people say, well, what is post-pandemic society going to be like, Brian? And my answer is, you know, uncertainty. Really, we are far from clear how this is all going to unfold.
Right.
But we are seeing, again, these same themes play out. I mean, I mentioned depopulation in the 14th century leading to a change in how workers, serfs at the time, viewed their condition and altered their attitudes. And, you know, we fast forward 700 years. And we're looking at things like the Great Resignation, that mm-hmm. is unprecedented numbers of people leaving their jobs, in part because of pandemics cause people to think about their current condition, about what they are doing, about how they want to spend the rest of their life, about taking advantage of new opportunities that may arise. And so we are seeing play out, albeit in a very different fashion, in this so-called Great Resignation, some of the same dynamics that have been apparent in previous centuries, even going back to the 1918-1919 flu pandemic. That was mm-hmm. followed by a period of labor militancy, of a wave of strikes. In a sense, again, the system adjusting mm-hmm. to fundamental changes. The Great Resignation, by the way, the term is not the invention of an economist. It's by Dr. Klontz, who is a psychologist. And what it really is, it's less about economics and I think more about attitudes of people, and pandemics fundamentally change attitudes.
Right. That's an interesting point, that the pandemic may be the ultimate cause or one of the ultimate causes for some of these changes, but there are many intervening variables. And you can't say COVID pandemic, great resignation. It's COVID pandemic, people in lockdown, many people, especially knowledge workers, in a position where they can function virtually, very similarly to the way they functioned in an office environment. But the displacement and the psychological feelings and the change in terms of people's values and what do you value when it comes to the use of your time, that's not all the pandemic. That's human psychology. That's sociology playing a role here. And the resignation, you can trace it back to the pandemic, but it couldn't have happened without some other things along the way that build on many disciplines in the social sciences.
That's true. And, you know, it's fascinating, David. Doctors talk about the concept of comorbidity. That is, the actual COVID-19 affects patients differently, and it affects them in many cases according to their pre-existing conditions. Some of them will be hit more severely by the disease because of pre-existing conditions, whether it's diabetes or obesity or respiratory problems. And that appears to be the case with societies as well. It's not necessarily that the pandemic causes these particular phenomena that we are seeing now, but rather that pandemics expose and exacerbate the existing inequalities, divisions, and other fault lines of our society, and in many cases even in individuals. And so it's not the pandemic as source, it is rather the pandemic as a complicating factor in deepening these effects.
Absolutely.
Doctors also are talking a great deal now about long COVID. That is the constellation of after effects of one having suffered COVID. And these range from everything from physiological problems to psychological problems to issues of brain fog and things of this sort. And sometimes I suspect that we are seeing a bit of the same thing as we move toward our own post-COVID society, our post-COVID landscape. And that is the lingering after effects of the pandemic itself. That is, for years after, we are going to be seeing manifestations of this. One study that was particularly fascinating involved the flu pandemic of 1918-1919. And there were already clues from previous pandemics that pandemics increased distrust in government institutions. And we can naturally understand how that happens. Governments are intervening in areas where they normally don't intervene. They're affecting people's lives. And yet there's still death and devastation as a consequence of this. One can see that happen. So that part was not particularly surprising in a study that looked at the legacy of distrust following the 1918 pandemic. What was fascinating was that using some fascinating methodology, the researchers were able to demonstrate that this level of distrust was passed on to future generations. That is, children, grandchildren, even great-grandchildren, whose forebears had suffered deeply through the 1918 pandemic, still had higher indications of distrust in government than others who came from backgrounds where the family had not suffered the same kind of loss and devastation resulting from the pandemic itself. So in other words, the distrust was really inheritable. And so as we transition to a more post-pandemic society, we're uncertain yet as to what the long-term psychological consequences, both at the societal level and at the individual level, will be of our collective experience of going through the COVID-19 pandemic.
Sure. But we do have a sense of some of the wider political implications of it. That is, some of the reactions to it that build on that distrust that grows manifest themselves, well, really in two ways. And we'll do the positive first, and then we'll go back to what you and I like to study the most, which is the negative. So the positive is, even during this pandemic, we've seen it, which is it can bring out the best of human nature. You see it in medical personnel. You see it in neighborhoods. You see people looking out for each other in a way that maybe they didn't when things weren't so dire. Okay, now to the negative. The negative side is some of the worst sides of human nature, like scapegoating, you know, finding someone to blame, which most often in history ends up being one of various minorities, whether religious minorities, ethnic minorities, you name it, whether it's people banding together to take direct action against perceived government overreach. You see this transition from the dynamics of, you know, relative deprivation and some of the economic effects we've talked about, some of the personal psychology manifesting itself as resistance to authority and even political violence. Talk through that dynamic a little bit. What can we say about the relationship both ways between pandemics and political violence?
You know, you pointed to one thing which has certainly been a common feature of pandemics, going back to the Great Plague of Athens, the Athenians.
You're going old school, Brian.
All the way back, yeah. I mean, the Athenians blamed it blamed it on the Spartans, and during the Justinian Plague in the late Roman Empire, it was blamed on what was then a rising minority of Christians. And through the Middle Ages, Christian societies, blamed it on the Jews or on the Gypsies. In more recent years, we've seen the blame fall on Asians, and not just in the COVID-19 pandemic, but I mean there were during the late 19th century, early 20th century, there were violent attacks on Asians in this country as a consequence of outbreaks of disease. So that's a common feature. We do see evidence of in previous pandemics of a fraying of the fabric of society, of an increase in antisocial behavior. Those who study this say, well, this reflects, you know, a prolonged isolation, anxiety. We see increases in irritability. One thing we are seeing in the current pandemic, which to me is fascinating from the standpoint of violence, increases in violence itself are not without precedent. The homicide rate in the United States in 2020 jumped up by about close to 30% in the United States, and it was followed by another increase in 2021, less dramatic. But if we put those 24 months together, we've seen in the United States a statistical increase of homicides by 38%. Now that's a dramatic increase. It's the largest gain that we've seen in many, many decades. But apart from murders, which you can count easy, we're seeing another phenomenon which we really don't have a way to capture statistically yet, and that is the increase in what I'll simply call random social aggression. That is, these are acts of violence, unprovoked violence, not connected with ordinary crime. I mean, we're not talking about muggings here or armed robberies, and which have no political nexus. There's no ideological motivation. This is simply people at random behaving violently toward one another. You know, in New York in 2021, there were over 60 people pushed off of subway platforms into the path of oncoming trains.
Right.
That itself is not a new crime, but, you know, certainly a dramatic increase in behavior. We're seeing just random attacks. In some cases, we're picking this up at train stations, on surface transportation, and interestingly enough, on airplanes as well, with unruly passengers, which has become a major problem. And it's not because of the venues themselves, except that these are simply places where populations of strangers come together. And people seem to be on edge, quick to violence. That was a feature that was noted in the Middle Ages following the Black Death. Again, people on edge, quick to violence. And we're seeing it again now. We don't have good statistics, but it has become a major issue. Is it the result of isolation? Is it the result of social stress? Is it the result of widespread mental illness? We don't have an explanation, and so back to my field of trying to understand violence, collective violence, terrorism, things of that sort. This is one area that I'm really trying to understand, and indeed in the process of gathering more detailed information, both quantitative and qualitative, about these incidents, to try to get a handle on what's going on here. It is a phenomenon.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare 20.
One other factor that builds into this before we do talk specifically about terrorism and the use of biological weapons is the issue of communications as a political repercussion of pandemics. During any pandemic, and we've seen it in the COVID-19 pandemic, public officials were at least accused of and sometimes did provide inconsistent and conflicting information, which feeds into some of these dynamics we've talked about in terms of mistrust and distrust. But that's not unique to pandemics, right? Whenever there's an issue with communication, it exacerbates issues of cultural divide. And you tell a story about an investigative company where you were working that was called in to assist with a major American corporation whose founder had been accused of worshiping Satan and devoting corporate profits to a satanic cult. Talk through that case study and the issue of communications and what you learned from that, and how that really illuminates some things about the way that pandemic communications have political results.
You know, that particular case and the phenomenon we're talking about really has to do with rumors and how rumors spread. And in looking at that case, I was called in to assist. We were actually just like epidemiologists who trace back to patient zero. We looked at the rumor. We had dates of the very first reports of the rumor, and we were actually able to, on a map, plot a timeline and go backward and in a sense, not quite find patient zero or, you know, source of rumor number one, but we were able to localize the where it first occurred. And we were then able to look at how it spread. And it was following the interstate highway, which was fascinating. It was going right down. You could track it. The reports of the rumor as it began to spread across, in particularly the southeastern part of the United States. And you know, I actually ended up as part of that case talking to theologians, because the question I had is this is about the devil and you know, who is likely to believe this? And it turns out people who believe in the devil, not as a theological abstraction of evil, as a real entity, in a sense, a living, fire-breathing devil. And so that gave us some clues because we were able to use, in a sense, the distribution of religious beliefs on maps. And it enabled us to predict where the rumor was likely to find root. Find a hospitable environment, and where it was not likely to go, and that enabled us really to get beyond the rumor. Just as when you fight a wildfire, you get out beyond it and you create a perimeter around it.
Yeah,
and therefore we were able to block that particular rumor. But here again, just as in dealing with a contagious disease, rumors mutate. And the rumor went right up to the edges of where we tried to block it, and it mutated into another form and went right beyond the perimeter. And took off in a new direction. And again, that's, you know, that's certainly something we've seen with all of the multiple variations of COVID-19.
And we're talking, Brian, we're talking about the late 80s, early 90s, and that's not even today's environment of the internet, social media, 24/7 news channels, heightened partisanship. I have a feeling that those rumors would have mutated faster, would have spread well beyond any perimeter you could have set up. Even though it's only been, 30 years since you did that, it's almost a different political environment now.
You're absolutely right. We did not have to deal with the internet. We were not dealing with social media. We were dealing with something that was spreading primarily, you know, mouth to mouth, primarily by individuals, occasionally propagated on a radio talk show or something like that, or a TV talk show. But we did not have the internet. And in today's environment, that has fundamentally changed things in terms of the velocity and the the magnitude of reach that the internet and social media provide. And we certainly could not have, you know, in today's environment. And that is a fundamental change. Now back to the political differences. You know, look, if we were dealing with something like the Black Death, which, as I said, wiped out as much as half the population of Europe, literally that is bodies piling up in the street. And COVID-19, fortunately, never got to that level. I mean, we're still talking about something that has fortunately killed, you know, approximately a third of 1% of the American population. Now, in terms of total numbers, that's big. Yeah. I mean,
that's many, many lives. And I don't think either one of us wants to minimize that. But compared to something even like the 1918, 1919 pandemic, and certainly to some of the pandemics in the Middle Ages, it's an entirely different level.
It is. And so what that has meant, I mean, first of all, these numbers that are being reported, you know, in the press are just that. They're abstract numbers. And in the absence of visible evidence of imminent doom, again, bodies piling up in the streets, the risk to human life can be weighed against the risk to economic well-being, individual freedom, potential social disorder, and people can come to different conclusions. And people have come to different conclusions about whether greater harm was done by the social distancing, by the isolation, by the closing of schools, by the shutting down of a great chunk of commerce, or was the greater threat the loss of life? Now, again, we go back to pre-existing conditions. Given that the United States was already going into the pandemic a polarized society politically, our politics have deeply divided the nation. Those differences very, very quickly conformed to political attitudes, and what it did is it really deepened the political divide. And so, you know, had COVID-19 posed a much greater threat to life, then somehow the shared dread might have forced social bonding. But yeah, it was serious enough to demand collective action, but not dangerous enough to set aside our differences.
Let's apply this to the issue of your primary expertise of terrorism, and related to that, the use of biological weapons as a tool. What does history suggest about the cause and effect links between pandemics and, no kidding, terrorist activity?
And you know, one thing you see right immediately is the attempts by political extremists to explain the pandemic in ways that will benefit their particular cause, and to exploit it if they can as a recruiting tool.
I seem to recall at least some leaders of the Islamic State were claiming that this is Allah's punishment for the infidels, and trying to basically fit COVID-19 into their existing narrative.
You're absolutely right. And that again, historically, is not new. I mean, again, you know, go back to the
to the Roman Empire, and people saying, well, we haven't been paying appropriate attention to our traditional Roman gods. Mm-hmm. And instead we are challenged by these bothersome Christians. The gods are punishing us for our substandard zeal. That's a recurring theme. So one, to explain it in ways that reinforce the extremist beliefs, then to use it as a recruiting tool. So those who are already white supremacists or anti-Semitic or anti-Muslim or anti-immigration, those extremists will immediately attempt to exploit the pandemic, not only to scapegoat, but in a sense to encourage their followers. I recall one thing that appeared on one of the white supremacists in white supremacist websites, and was moving around in those circles. And it was a poster. It was, in a sense, a mock-up of a CDC poster. And it said, if you are infected with COVID-19, visit your local synagogue, visit your local mosque, go to your local ethnically diverse neighborhood to spread the contagion.
Ooh.
And again, this goes back to a narrative. There are a lot of, the other thing we've seen on the internet are a lot of online fantasies, genocidal fantasies, how can the COVID-19 be exploited, not simply to increase total casualties, but to affect certain segments of society more than others. And here we get into some, almost philosophical areas that have fascinated people for a long time. I mean, we all have an understanding of the concept of genocide, and that is trying to kill as many people of one particular race or religion or tribe or ethnic group, but not others. Something like the pandemic is fascinating in terms of its capability to kill large numbers of people. But the challenge, the operational challenge, is it's just killing everybody, and it's not simply killing the right people, so to speak. And so we're seeing a lot of genocidal fantasies and so on. I don't know that COVID-19, the pandemic itself, has opened, given political extremists any new ideas that they haven't thought about already. What it has done clearly is it has prompted a lot of people to think about biological weapons. And that probably is not a good idea. I mean,
right. That's such a good point, because I think in the general public, the fact is during the COVID pandemic, we have not seen catastrophic terrorist attacks. We haven't seen a 9/11 style event. We haven't seen, certainly in the West, we haven't seen what we would consider even a major plot that was brought to fruition. So I think the general view is that terrorism, if not stopped, that the pandemic certainly dampened the terrorist impulse. But your point is there's there's two factors there. One is that there's the belief in terrorism, that many people believe that the threat of terrorism has increased. And that feeds into these general political issues. And secondly, of course, that the whole idea of using pathogens as weapons is not new, and it has been done in the past, including in the United States in the 1980s. But has that put the idea into people's heads enough that it's only a matter of time before somebody weaponizes a pathogen in a new way?
It is a cause for concern, and certainly what we have seen that as well, that this has brought the pandemic has brought renewed attention to the area of pandemics, of widespread outbreaks of disease. Whether those have natural causes or represent an escaped pathogen from some biological laboratory, which was, you know, certainly is one of the explanations for the origins of COVID-19, or whether it is a deliberate attack by a state or non-state enterprise, that has become a major issue. Now, again, to look at this more broadly for a moment, and to bring in some of the other complicating factors that you alluded to in your earlier comments, which is appropriate, we are now not just dealing with the aftermath of COVID-19 and the possibility of new outbreaks of disease, but we're also dealing with a major war for the first time in decades in Europe, a war that has had very, very far-reaching effects in terms of world food supplies, and that has already brought about the specter of the possible use of nuclear weapons. And that environment, those two in combination, have created even greater uncertainty about the future. And a third dimension is of course what we see in terms of weather-related events, widespread droughts across the world, which are resulting in famines in some parts of the world. You know, and here we are in the 21st century, and we're dealing with pestilence, we're dealing with war, we're dealing with famine. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the horsemen of the apocalypse, and that again does affect our individual and collective mindsets, and creates for many people an extremely stressful environment, and we're not sure how people are going to react to that.
And it is important to note that, you know, the idea of biological terrorism, you know, isn't new. I mean, even in fiction, the 19th century had several novels that were talking about germ warfare, and H.G. Wells famously wrote The Stolen Bacillus about, as I recall, it was an anarchist plot to poison the water supply in London or somewhere else in the UK with, was it cholera? It was something of that sort. So this isn't a new idea. It's not that COVID-19 is going to create an idea that isn't out there, but it's one of those things that, with all the other things you've mentioned that we are collectively worried about now, the threat of terrorism on the grand scale certainly hasn't gone away. And the threat of biological terrorism may be something that we need to pay even more attention to now.
No, that's absolutely true. And as I say, it's not a prediction that biological terrorism will occur. And I tend to shy away from statements, you know, not if, but when, that imply a degree of inevitability.
Right.
But again, because of the combination of warfare, the weather and climate, developments that we are seeing, how everyone feels about those, plus these outbreaks of disease, that we are now in a new environment. And at the same time, interestingly enough, our ability to mobilize either globally or nationally to deal with these has become more difficult. One of the casualties of the pandemic is governability. We're already dealing with deeply divided societies. We're dealing with a growing distrust in institutions, in our political systems. We are dealing with economic stress. We are confronting, in a sense, the phenomenon of anti-science, and we're dealing with disinformation, misinformation that spreads on the internet, at the speed of light.
Yeah.
And that's something that we're not well organized right now to deal with, and it's uncertain how we will deal with that. I mean, how will we deal with these challenges, especially in a democratic society, which is always going to be a bit more disorganized and certainly turbulent than an absolute dictatorship. But to look at the contrast, by the way, democracies didn't perform exceptionally well in the pandemic. The advanced countries of the world didn't perform exceptionally well, which is not to say that totalitarian countries did especially well either. And we look now at China in their absolute shutdowns to deal with outbreaks of COVID-19, which are still taking place in the country. And I see recently that they're facing growing resistance and violence in China. So how do we govern in an environment where, for a variety of reasons, which the pandemic has exacerbated, how do we govern, especially in democracies, and remain democracies?
Sure. And it really highlights the dynamic you brought up earlier, which is that there have been thousands of years of political theory trying to devise what's the ultimate purpose of the state and collective action. And these reactions to COVID really highlight this, that on the one hand, you can say that the main purpose of the state is to protect the well-being of the overall state, in which case economic health is part of that. And you can't do too dramatic of a shutdown because it hurts the economy. And maybe it's actually worth sacrificing some lives and taking some casualties to do that, in a metaphor for actual physical war. On the other side, of course, is the fact that the good of a country could be measured in terms of the welfare of the population, in which case the priority is on saving lives, even if that means interrupting social, political, economic activity to do so. And you're right, you've seen both countries, like at one extreme, not necessarily succeeding, and then countries at the other extreme not succeeding. So it doesn't actually give us any purchase on that fundamental political question of which way of looking at the collective good is right in all cases.
No, that you're absolutely right. And so, as I say, we're seeing all of these trends come together in a much more turbulent world. In a certain respect, and of course I speak as an older man, yes, we have gone through turbulent times in our own history. I mean, in our own country, gosh, the 1960s were a period of enormous turbulence and not a small volume of domestic political turmoil and violence that gave rise to the terrorist bombing campaigns in this country of the 1970s. So the mm-hmm. fact that we have gone through this before, and you know, one can have a personal memory of that period, is somewhat reassuring. At the same time, we look at these new developments and a deeper polarization and the technology of social media and mass resistance along these philosophical lines, and you say, you know, what perhaps the past, that we saw was comparatively less challenging, more tranquil, although during the Cold War we faced, you know, the prospect of nuclear war. In many respects, that was something that was more manageable than what we are confronting now. And so it is worrisome. And that is not, it's not that the pandemic, again, has caused that. It is that the pandemic has exposed it and exacerbated it.
To put a bow on this, Brian, I'd like to connect this conversation to a recent work you've published elsewhere, which takes on a really difficult challenge, and you dive right in, which is trying to create a pragmatic, no kidding strategy to counter domestic political violence while doing no harm. That is, without, you know, putting alcohol in the flames. In your way of writing that up in the U.S. Military Academy's publication, the CTC Sentinel, you write about many of the dynamics that have combined to make this a particularly dangerous moment for domestic political violence in the United States. And among those factors, it is by far not the only one, but among those factors are factors that are correlated with the pandemic, things that the pandemic itself exacerbated. And I'm wondering if you could kind of make that connection for us here to close out. How is it that the rise in potential and actual domestic political violence in the U.S. that I know you're concerned about, enough that you've crafted a strategy to try to deal with it, how is the pandemic feeding into and blending with that to make this an even more sticky problem?
Well, we were already dealing with a fraught situation, and perhaps that situation is the right word. You know, I'm a former soldier and was commissioned in the infantry. And the first thing you learn as an infantry officer is everything depends on the terrain and the situation. And so before crafting or thinking about any strategy, you look in this sense at the political terrain and the situation, and that tells you that the United States, because of our political divisions, because of this, because of the increase in random violence and individual violence. Thus far, fortunately, not many manifestations of collective violence. But because of that, the United States is in a delicate situation. And as any physician, the first rule is do no harm. And so you want to be careful in terms of any type of approach, any type of strategy that you don't make conditions worse. And we could end up inadvertently doing that so easily. And therefore, the strategy that I recommend, the elements of what I call a pragmatic strategy, and pragmatic is the operative word, it really aims, is primarily a set of cautionary notes. In other words, be very, very careful that you don't do something to make things worse. You want to isolate those who might carry out acts of violence. Certainly you'd like to prevent that, but not do so in a way that turns half the country into enemies of the state. You need to prosecute when necessary. The law really provides the guardrails against political violence, but the prosecution ought to focus on the crime, not political motivation. And that is, don't get deeply into the idea that a strategy to counter political violence will become part of a political crusade to deal with, to advance one's political agenda. That would be extremely dangerous. We have to keep law enforcement here in a widely accepted law enforcement role. So those are some of the elements of it. And we may even, you know, one of the trends has been really over the past 25 years or so, there's been great pressure on law enforcement to move from a traditional reactive posture where a crime is committed and law enforcement investigations attempt to identify the perpetrator, apprehend that individual, and bring them into a courtroom. That's a traditional approach. And the pressure has been, especially as a consequence of terrorism, that we have to instead move first to prevent. So we have to intervene and affect the thinking and motivation of those who might be involved. That might have to be not abandoned, but we might have to back off on that a bit. And if we're going to, I'm not saying police should not intervene where they can to prevent a crime from taking place, but the idea of broader social interventions to identify persons who might be vulnerable to radicalization and recruitment to violence is something, again, we want to be careful of. And it's very, very interesting to look at the parallels in terms of dealing with outbreaks of disease and dealing with in a sense, rising violent ideologies. Do we try to adopt extraordinary measures to head off political violence, which might be in certain circumstances counterproductive in terms of holding our political system together? Or do we instead say, look, we're going to have to accept that some events, tragic events, will occur, and we're not going to be able to stop these. And if we try to intervene, then we are going to risk deepening the divisions and making things even worse. So ought not to think of ideology as a contagious disease.
I got to tell you, that's a hard message for people to hear, but something important to think about is, and you caveated that at the beginning by saying, no, if there's an actual criminal act, yes, law enforcement needs to do its job. But the idea of, in a sense, you know, holding back on, I don't know what you'd call it, pre-crime, holding back on issues that are radicalizing in order not to spur the radicalization, there's definitely a lot of debate over that. But that's, like you said, that's why the operative word is a pragmatic strategy, because you're trying to find something to put into action that does no harm and makes things better in the medium to long term.
No, that really is critical. And what we face now in this country in terms of domestic political violence is, in my view, going to be a lot more difficult than our comparatively, you know, there were certainly egregious failures and injustices done at certainly at the beginning, but we did manage in a post 9/11 environment the threat posed by homegrown jihadists. Right. Now right. there were some tragedies to be sure, but overall, as I say, it can be judged to have worked. That is not going to be the template, however, for our strategy going forward. There are just so many differences. We're not dealing with something that is seen in the country as an alien ideology or belief mm-hmm. system. We're dealing with whether it's philosophical beliefs or whether it's deeply embedded prejudices in our society. We're dealing with currents in our history that go back a couple of centuries. Yeah. We're not going to be able to suddenly, in the name of countering political violence, strip mine American society of bigotry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we ought not to have that.
I wish you were wrong, but I fear you're right about that, which is we deal with the society we have, not with the society that we'd idealize. These are all challenging issues, and I appreciate your insight and really your perspective on these to help illuminate some of our current dynamics through the study of the plagues and the recoveries from them, but also trying to look at what's different and what's the same about that in its impact on domestic political violence. But, you know, we do end the podcast episodes with a reach into our chatterbox, and I'm going to pull out a random question to close. Brian, who is someone in your field or a related one whose work more people should be following?
Oh, golly. I would almost want to say in some respects that we want to go back to some of the works that fall outside of the more narrowly defined realm of political terrorism. I mean, we want to look at things like Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, which gets into the dynamics of people's belief systems, that we want to look at in some cases, even going back to some of the novels that were written in the 19th century, early 20th century about anarchism, and where the novelist really got a handle on people's attitudes and beliefs. This is the analysis of political violence is not really about events. You know, you can find that in a chronology.
Right.
It's about human behavior. About
psychology, sociology. I mean, you immediately, when you bring up anarchist novels, I immediately go to G.K. Chesterton and The Man Who Was Thursday, which was just, I don't want to say fun because it was disturbing in its own way, but what an interesting way of looking at the social dynamics of early terrorism.
You know, you're absolutely right. You have to read things like Dostoevsky and things of this sort to get at notions of how people think. And so it's not a matter of nominating, you know, the expert on terrorism. It's really about understanding human behavior, which is so much more difficult. And without any assumption that you're going to get the answer right.
That's the hard part. You gain insight, you gain some understanding, but you don't, it's not a magic solution machine, right?
Right. Well,
Brian, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your experiences and insights. Thanks for coming on Chatter.
Well, thank you so much. And I enjoyed the conversation. Obviously, as I said, you know, at the outset, this is something I've worked on for decades. That leads to a problem that I can speak about it for days unless interrupted. And again, thank you for the excellent questions. I've really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at @ThatWasChatter.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.